rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's the first hour of our last program of the week. And as always, for the last going on 3 years here now, Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us, the only independent member, the longest serving independent member of the House of Representatives in its history, in that body's history, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, and now the second for this coming up legislative session, the second elected independent member of the United States Senate, a senator-elect Bernie Sanders. Bernie, is Bernie.org still your main website?
Bernie.org is the campaign website, and Bernie.house.gov is the congressional website, and we're probably going to be phasing that out and get a Senate website pretty soon. But Bernie.house.gov will be the most updated website.
Okay, great. I'm not sure if I should call you congressman, senator-elect, senator. How do you address somebody at this point in the transition?
Bernie would be fine.
Okay. Bernie, welcome to the program. Great to have you here. What are your thoughts about what's happened with the election and the direction that Congress might be heading now that we have Democratic majorities?
A couple of things, Tom. I think the American people have been given an opportunity now to do some extraordinary things. And the very good news, and, you know, you and I have, we talk every Friday, and I was hopeful that this might happen, but you know, the odds were that it would not happen, that we would capture, the Democrats would capture both the House and the Senate. And that gives us just an unusual opening to do some really good things. And obviously, the first thing that has to happen is an end to the right-wing extremism coming out of the Bush administration. And I think that in fact, is going to happen. But the harder task is to see where we can go forward as a nation on issue after issue. And furthermore, how we engage the American public in a way that we haven't done in the past. Because my view is, and we should be clear, you have a president who could veto any legislation coming out of Congress. To get anything substantive through the Senate, you really need 60 votes. You need 60 votes.
Enough to overcome a filibuster.
Exactly. So you got, you know, serious problems there.
And you need 66 to overcome a veto, don't you?
No.
Oh, is it also 60?
Yeah.
60,
so,
okay.
The way that things can happen, to my mind, and what's important for now and in the future, is to really engage the American people in standing up for their rights, so that when they put pressure on those people who want to stop progress, that those people will have to pay a political price for that. And just yesterday, I was talking with some people about higher education, and every listener knows, if you have kids or if you're in college, you know. The cost of college education is soaring. You know that Bush and his friends cut back on financial aid for middle-class college families, which will make college even more expensive. If we can rally, just as one example of many, students all over this country to say, hey, this is nonsense. Every person in America who has the ability, who has the desire, should be able to go to college because they're an American citizen, and it's important that we have the best educated workforce in the world, you know what? We can do that.
Yeah, that was Thomas Jefferson's vision, you know, when he created the University of Virginia as
exactly.
a free college.
Exactly.
this is the original American idea.
That's right. I mean, how dumb is it? And it's not just for the individual who obviously, when that young man or woman has a college degree, will be earning more, will be having an opportunity to make it into the middle class. But as a nation as a whole, we can't afford not to have the best educated workforce in the world. So it is an investment. This is not a cost. It is an investment in the future. Every company in America that has any brains at all, makes investments in research and development. You improve the quality of your company to be competitive. That's what we need to do as a nation. Now, can we do it? We sure can. Can you do it without the involvement of millions of people in this country standing up to fight for that? No, we can't. I can introduce legislation tomorrow, which will get a certain number of votes. I doubt that it would get the 60 votes that we would need. So we need to rally the American people. Same issue on veterans. You have what is one of the areas that we don't talk about very much is the horrendous way that the Bush administration has treated our veterans. They've thrown hundreds of thousands of veterans off of VA health care, so-called Category 8 veterans, people who don't have service-connected disabilities, and who have incomes over $27,000 a year. If that person walked into a VA hospital today, they would not be eligible for VA health care. That's wrong. So instead of giving tax breaks by the hundreds of billions to millionaires and billionaires, we make sure we take care of our veterans. Can we do that? Well, frankly, we don't have the votes to do it right now. But if veterans all over this country stood up and demanded that, yup, we could do that. Issue after issue, the American people have got to be engaged in the political struggles that take place here in Washington, because we can't do it alone. So we need to close that gap between ordinary Americans and what goes on here in Washington in a very significant way.
Sounds like you're saying what I've been saying, with slightly different words, what I've been saying since Election Day, which is that this is not the end. This is just the beginning. And it's the beginning of the necessity of our involvement. People think, okay, the election's over, so, you know, I gave my $25 and I showed up and I walked the precinct and now I'm done. And I'm saying, no, you just started.
And let's underline that issue, because this is terribly important. You and I, you know, we have talked on Fridays for many years now. And what I have said for the last number of months is the struggle does not end on Election Day. We urge people to come out. We urge people to bring their uncles and their aunts and their neighbors and their coworkers out to vote, that this was the most important non-presidential election in modern American history. Well, it was. And you know what? We won. We won. But what I also said before the election is it doesn't end on Election Day. Mm-hmm. All right? It follows the very next day. And now we're talking about the very next day. And that next day is, we're not asking people to come out and vote. There's not going to be an election for 2 years. We have time to worry about that. But tomorrow, well, the Congress is kind of going to be adjourning in a couple of weeks. But in January, it is going to start up. And my understanding is that Harry Reid, the leader in the Senate, and Nancy Pelosi, the leader in the Senate, in the House, want to get going right out of the blocks. Normally what happens is members get sworn in on January 3rd, January 4th, then Congress takes a break and they come back for the president's State of the Union address, and then they get to work. I think Reid and Pelosi want to start off sooner than that, right in January, get to work on some of the important issues, and I think that's a good thing.
God bless them.
But what must happen is the American people must be engaged on those issues in the same way we're engaged in election struggle. That means start emailing your and writing to your senator, to the member of the House, about the issues that are of concern to you. Pay attention to the issues that are on the floor, and let's generate the kind of support that we need to pass this up. Because if the American people are not involved, especially working people, middle-class people, lower-income people are not involved, then the people who call the tunes here, who determine the priorities here, who pass the legislation, are the big money interests. They're not going away. Believe me, they're here. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be pushing as hard as they can. If we want to lower the cost of prescription drugs, you know what it's like taking on the pharmaceutical industry? Enormously powerful. If you want to move to sustainable energy, you've got to take on the oil companies. If you want to lower interest rates on your credit cards, you've got to take on the banks and the credit cards companies. Huge, huge special interest and powerful forces here that have to be engaged. We can't do it alone in Washington. We need the support of the American people.
Yeah, we have to create the parade, and
then
and then the politicians will get out in front of the parade and say, this is my parade.
Well, I don't know if it's getting out in front or being behind. It is working together. The American people are gonna, you know, can't deal with this issue unless there's legislation on the floor of the House and the Senate that people are fighting for. We can't win it unless there are people pushing that legislation forward.
Right. So what's the best way for somebody to contact their representatives? And I mean, you're not a Democrat or a Republican, and yet I'm assuming that you would encourage people, to, for either party, people who listen to this program of goodwill, to start getting active in locally at the political process.
Let me suggest this. First of all, it is not hard. There are, you know, good websites right here in Congress. Many people don't even know who their member of the House is. Most people know who their senator is. Find out who that person is. Get the email number. Now, I should mention, if you write letters and you send it to Washington, D.C., they're going to go very, very slowly, because ever since that anthrax horror, all mail is sent to a special place where it is irradiated and so forth. So it takes a couple of weeks to get here. Probably better if you want to send a letter, send it to the local district. Find out where that office is that your congressman or your senator has. You can go in and say hello. You may not get in to see the senator or the congressperson right away. You can meet with the staff. you can call up your congressperson's office or your senator's office and say, look, if we bring 50 people together or 100 people together, will you talk to us?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, begin to develop a relationship with your elected officials.
Yeah. At the national level, at the state level, at the county level, at the city level, all
every
the way through the
senator,
whole
state. Every member of the House has districts back home.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. We'll be taking your calls right after this break for Bernie Sanders. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman program. And welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman radio program. Bernie, I keep getting emails from people saying, when's Bernie going to run for president? So thus the bumper music. I know that you're really interested in the Senate here and making this thing work. And
yep.
We're so pleased to have you with us. We just heard from your office. I'm assuming that you heard it, too, that you have to leave in 20 minutes.
I have to leave in about 20, 25 minutes. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So we'll take a break at the bottom of the hour. We'll take some calls. We'll take a break at the bottom of the hour. We'll take some calls, and you just tell me when you got to head out of here, and we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, and congratulations, Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
My question is, what happens to legislation or bills that are already in the pipeline proposed by defeated Congress representatives and senators once the new session opens in January?
Well, any bill that was not on January 4th, the new session begins and we start from zero. So there is any bill that was introduced in this session is dead and no longer exists in the next session. It has to be reintroduced.
Interesting. Brian in Orange County, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning to both of you. I think we really need to fix our system of government so that our representatives truly are representing the collective will of the people. I think we can all agree that we need to get there from where we are now. Two big obstacles that I see that I think Bernie has a unique insight to are, first of all, Republican and Democrat infighting and the power and influence of big money and special interest groups to get legislation to benefit them. Now, Bernie has recently triumphed against an extremely expensive campaign in Vermont, and being an independent, I know has allowed you to actually gain the support of many Republicans in Vermont. What I'd like to know is, what is your vision as to what this repaired democracy may actually look like, and how specifically can we get there? Do we need more independence in higher office? I mean, do we need to pass really strict campaign reform that limits campaign contributions?
Well, Brian, that's an excellent question, Brian. I would say that the major problem that we have, and it's certainly not talked about enough, is simply the power of big money. We see the power of big money right here on Capitol Hill in terms of the lobbyists who are all over the place. The pharmaceutical industry for itself, just one industry, has approximately 1,000 lobbyists for 535 members of Congress, including some of the former leaders of the Republican and Democratic Party. Huge and powerful forces. So the most important thing I think that we have got to set our sights on is electing a Congress which represents the needs of the middle class and ordinary people, working people, rather than just big money interests. And it's not just lobbyists playing a role every day in influencing legislation. It is big money electing the candidates in the first place. So big money plays a huge role, and we have got to deal with it. Now, how do you deal with it? Well, I think public funding of elections through campaign finance reform is enormously important. We want the day to come when anybody can run for office who has the ability and the support to do so and have a chance to win, even if you are A, not very wealthy, or B, beholden to wealthy and powerful special interests. Some of the states in the country are beginning to move in that direction. For example, in Maine, you had a governor's election. Three out of the four candidates were running on public funding for governor. And that created, I think, a kind of political climate in Maine with a lot more diversity of ideas than is normally the case. Arizona has made some progress. So public funding of elections, I think, is terribly important if we are going to elect people who represent the middle class and working families rather than just a wealthy and powerful special interest.
Well said. We do that here in Portland, Oregon, too, and it works really well for this.
Does it work pretty well?
Yeah, very, very well. Israel in Newark, New Jersey, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, there's another problem, but the one that I see that happened in the last three election cycles, I don't want it to repeat. I think the Democrats got lucky this time because inter-party problem between the Republicans, so the Democrats won. But I want a fair and prosperity election every time. Can you at least, you guys, the Senate now, do something about it, please, and I'll take it over.
I'll say it again. I didn't quite hear it.
He said he wants a fair and secure election.
Okay,
I think he's talking about
very,
from...
Very, very good point. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is an issue that comes up virtually every time Tom and I are together on the radio. People are very concerned. And, Tom, I think out in Florida, once again, we have a situation where a significant number of touchscreen ballots for a very tightly contested congressional race.
Thousands of missing votes, and they're gone into the silicon.
All right. Well, obviously, that is unacceptable. And this is an issue I'm going to take a very hard look at. And, you know, what Tom and I have discussed is the technology is not yet there where people feel comfortable that their ballots will be accurately counted. It appears that in Florida, once again, that was not the case. And if it means going back to paper ballots so that everybody feels secure, I would rather wait an extra hour for election results and know that every ballot was accurately counted than go through the kinds of situations that we have gone through and we know that we could go through. Very important issue.
Yeah, and in fact, we're waiting extra days and weeks in some cases because these things are so screwed up right now. I mean, there's still a bunch of races that haven't been resolved. If we'd just done paper, it would have just been an extra hour or two. Yeah. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more calls for Bernie right after this break. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman radio program. 27 minutes past the hour in the place where being progressive never felt so good.
And it's gone. Gone, everything gone. Give a damn. Gone be the birds when they don't wanna sing. Gone people. Awkward with their things.
And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, soon to be Senator Bernie Sanders, or I guess now Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, on the line with us. Patty in Dallas, Texas. You're live with Bernie.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I apologize. I called in simply because I was just watching MSNBC. And did President Bush just say the war on Iraq is similar to Vietnam and that we will succeed?
Who said that?
President Bush on MSNBC. It was a quote today.
The war in Iraq is similar to the war in Vietnam, and we will succeed.
We will. We have to keep trying. And I think that's a double quandary there, isn't it? Because Vietnam, they're not our enemies, but yet North Korea, didn't we win that war? I apologize for being ignorant.
Well, we did not win the war in Vietnam.
Right.
That's for sure. And
it's on MSNBC. There are exact quotes of him saying Vietnam.
Yeah, well, that's where he is right now too, Patty. What's interesting, I had this conversation, Bernie, this morning, and Patty, thanks for the call. I had this conversation this morning with a White House reporter who said that the Bush administration is now referring to the war in Vietnam, and every previous administration had referred to it as a conflict, the Vietnam conflict, because there was no formal declaration of war by Congress. And there's speculation that the Bush administration is trying to conflate the word war and the presidential powers that come from a declaration of war with the current Iraq conflict so that Bush can grab more presidential power. I don't know if, you know, it's interesting speculation.
That might be, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anyhow, Ed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yep. Ed, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Mr. Sanders, great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Ted.
The Democrats won that election based, number one reason was the war. Now, I think as a parent of a son who's been there and is due to be deployed next year, I'm going to ask you, for all the other parents of all those kids, to remind the Democrats and to let's get out of there now. I don't want to hear any more timeline stories or any more BS. We have to get out now. And if you would do that, I would be forever in your debt.
Well, thanks, Ted. I think you're right in saying that certainly This election was a rejection of Bush's policies, in my view. In general, I think the war was at the top of the list. I think we've got to get out of Iraq as soon as we possibly can. I don't know that we can do it tomorrow, but I do believe we can do it quite soon. I think we can get all our troops home within the year, and that's something I certainly will be working on. And we wish your son and all the other young men and women of the American Armed Forces in Iraq the best of luck, and we hope that they're all as safe as they possibly can be.
Amen. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. Congratulations on your win last week.
Thank you.
I was wondering, do you have any idea what committees you're going to be put on?
Like, yes, I do. That was just announced the other day, and I'm very grateful. Senator Reid was very kind. In fact, I got on all the committees that I wanted to be on, and that was the Health, Education, and Labor Committee with Senator Kennedy, the Environmental Committee with Senator Boxer, the Energy Committee with Senator Bingaman, the Veterans Committee with Senator Inouye, and the Budget Committee with Ken Conrad.
Great. And I have one other quick question. Last week, the president made a comment about making sure his warrantless program gets passed during this lame duck session. Why does he seem to think that that's so important to get passed now? Because for the last 2.5 to 3 years, he said, he was constitutionally able to do anything he wanted to, basically.
Well, that's a very good question, and I hope it does not get passed, and I hope we can begin a very serious discussion in the next Congress about how you protect the American people from terrorism and you do it in a way that doesn't undermine civil liberties that protect our constitutional rights. So I hope I certainly hope that in this lame duck session this does not get passed.
Peter in Sarasota Springs, New York. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
How you doing, gentlemen? Bernie, I have a question that once the hearings begin on Iraq and we begin the oversight and we start uncovering things, I know Nancy Pelosi said we are not going to impeach this president. My question is, once those hearings begin and everything starts coming out, how are we going to avoid it?
Well, I think, Peter, you raise a good question, and where you start is with the hearings, and we see what progresses. And we don't want to jump the gun here. But I think what is important is that for the first time in 6 years, my hope and expectation is there will be serious hearings on Iraq on many other issues, including how did we get into Iraq, why did we get into Iraq, what did the president know, when did he know it. As I think many of the listeners know, there is a lot of speculation out there that the president had the intention of invading Iraq long before 9/11, and 9/11 was used as a pretense for policies that had been developed long before that horrendous day. We should know that. We should know what the truth is and what the truth is not. We should bring architects of the Iraq policy right before the U.S. Senate and U.S. House. They should be subpoenaed. They should be asked hard questions. The American people are entitled to the answers.
Armin in Bradenton, Florida. You're live with Bernie Sanders. And I'm in Bernie, by the way.
Hey, Bernie, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
The Republican Nazi Party better beware because the SS is coming after them, and that's Senator Sanders.
No. Whoa.
Lousy metaphor.
I really don't like that phraseology.
Okay. Armin, thanks a lot. We'll move along. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Senator Bernie. It's a pleasure talking to you. I had heard a rumor that Kucinich has already introduced a bill that would require paper ballots and hand counting for the 2008 presidential election. Is that true? And if so, would you know what the bill number is?
Well, no bill for the new session can be introduced yet. So I don't know if anyone is working on that bill. Tom, do you know the answer to that?
I believe that Dennis Kucinich, I know that he's made an announcement to that effect. Whether
that
he's introduced a bill or not, I don't know.
Okay.
But I know he certainly intends to.
Okay, that won't be introduced until the next session in January. Right.
So all this stuff starts in January.
Okay.
Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, congratulations, Senator-elect.
Thank you, Rick.
I wanted to ask you this question last week, and you had to leave early, and Tom tried to answer it for me. But the situation with Joe Lieberman, apparently he was interviewed on Meet the Press, and he has not ruled out possibly you know, jumping to the Republicans. I know you're not a mind reader, but, I mean, he was one of your colleagues in the other body, as they say. Do you think we can trust him to caucus with the Democrats?
Now, everything that I have heard is that Joe Lieberman will caucus with the Democrats.
That's good. Brian in New Hampshire, Manchester, New Hampshire. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. And Senator-elect Sanders, I called you Senator-elect two or three times during this year. And
now you got it right, Brian.
Now I've got the legal and constitutional right to do so, and I feel great doing so, Senator-elect Sanders, sir. Yeah, good luck to you. But I want to know, for my fellow veterans and for all the veterans coming home from Iraq, is increasing VA funding and perhaps setting up new veterans administrations, hospitals and centers for it's easier for veterans to get to them in rural areas of the country. My retired Florida father in Florida and people like that all over the country. That especially these kids coming home from Iraq, especially, is a increased veterans funding and increased veterans health care, actual health care. Is that going to be one of the top priorities?
Ryan, that is going to be one of my very, very top priorities. We are treating our veterans shamefully, the older veterans and the younger ones who are coming home with so many problems. We're going to increase funding. I'm going to do everything I can to increase funding, make health care more accessible, make sure that we have the tools to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. We also want to, what I want to do is to make sure the so-called Category 8 veterans are brought back into VA health care. VA does a great job, but they're not magicians. They need the money. They need the staff to do it well. And I'm going to do everything that I can to make sure that the VA is adequately funded.
Bernie, the Category 8 ones are the ones that Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary, referred to as the rich veterans?
Let me give you an example of a quote-unquote rich veteran. And this is one of the outrages that just has not been talked about enough. What Bush said is that if you are a World War II veteran, if you're 85 years of age, if you need to get into a VA hospital and you never have been in one before, if you have income of above $27,000 a year, you can't get in there. So hundreds and hundreds of thousands of veterans who want to use the VA service, want to take advantage of the prescription drug program, no longer are able to do so. But we do have hundreds of billions of dollars available for tax breaks for the richest 1%. But we do turn our backs on the Bush on veterans who put their lives on the line who make more than $27,000 a year. So this is one of the outrages that we wanted to end.
And well said. Diana in Olympia, Washington, we only have about 30 seconds left. Quick question for Bernie.
Well, you give me hope, Bernie. My best $30 I ever sent to a candidate. Is there a chance? I taped your speech in the 94 about the NAFTA bill. Is there a chance that we can turn that around?
Diana, good question. There is one of the results of this election is that some of the strongest pro-unfettered free trade members of the Senate were defeated, and a number of us are going in who want to reverse our trade policies. So I think we're still in the minority, but the momentum is clearly with those of us who are going to challenge current trade policies, including NAFTA, PNTR with China.
So fair trade instead of free trade.
That's right.
Bernie Sanders, I know you have to run, Bernie, so thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
It is always great.
Talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Indeed. Bye now. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. We'll be back after this break. I'll be taking your calls. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Our program supported by you supporting our radio stations, our affiliates, and the sponsors of SAME. Please patronize the sponsors you hear on your local stations and our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, all organic, all fair trade. Their website, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Some of the finest coffees from all over the world. I was having Peruvian coffee this morning. Wow! 1-800-425-2532, their telephone number. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, www.smalldog.com, 1-800-511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine, 1-888-EcoWine, or EcoWine.com. It's 51 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Merrill in Everett, Washington. Hey, Merrill, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Hi,
yes, Merrill. Yes, I wanted to ask Bernie if the Senate would support an open public investigation of 911.
I don't think they're going to be able to resist the pressure to do so. The 9/11 Commission, for example, was not able to question George Bush or Dick Cheney under oath. In fact, Bush would only testify if Cheney sat next to him, and I understand one of the provisions was that Bush could not be speaking when Cheney was drinking water. And so that's a joke. And so
I think it's not likely that we could question those people, but what I would like to see is the work of independent investigators such as
like David Reed,
Stephen Jones,
yeah, and David
Alex
Reed Griffin,
Jones, and
yeah.
Webster Tarpley, who have done so much work to indicate this was a false flag operation.
Yeah, no, I agree that there needs to be a serious investigation of this. We've had David Ray Griffin on this program two or three times. Alex Jones has been on this program. We've discussed this a number of times, and it is absolutely. We need to have, you know, the equivalent of like the House committee hearings in, I forget what year they were, but in the 60s that looked into the assassination of JFK, for example. I mean, serious hearings with subpoena power, calling witnesses, and, you know, just doing it and doing it right. And that's not what we've got right now. Merrill, thanks a lot for the call. Eldon, driving in Colorado. Hey, Eldon, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Tom, I'm so glad to get to talk to you. I'm asking about the possibility of prosecution of George W. Bush for crimes such as listening to phone calls,
yeah,
and so forth.
Right, the unlawful wiretaps, torture.
After his presidency has expired.
It is possible, Eldon. It may not happen in the United States, although it legally could happen in the United States after he's left the presidency, unless the incoming president pardons him. That's Jerry Ford pardoning Richard Nixon. He did so that Nixon couldn't be prosecuted as a private citizen for things that he did as president, for crimes that he committed. We could see prosecution overseas. I mean, right now you've got the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org, their website. The Center for Constitutional Rights this week bringing war crime charges against Don Rumsfeld. They could just as easily extend that beyond Don Rumsfeld to George W. Bush, and may well. So, yeah, I think that it's entirely possible that he could be prosecuted. It's going to require we, the people, standing up and becoming the parade. We have to get out there and speak up and speak out. Thanks a lot for the call. Ken in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ken, what's up?
How are you, Tom? I want to change the subject a little bit here.
Sure.
Wanted to talk about the labor laws and what this Senate and Congress has done to them, and stacking the labor board and the bad decisions that came out of the presidency.
It's not the Senate and Congress who stacked the labor board. It's the president. The National Labor Relations Board is appointed by the executive branch.
But the president said that the labor laws were antiquated and we no longer needed them, and he had the House and the Senate to change them. I'm wondering if I wanted to talk to Bernie about it, but it seems like it's never been on the. It doesn't come up as often. I know there's a lot bigger issues, but that's the war on the middle class right now.
I agree with you, and I guarantee you that Bernie will bring that up because Bernie's one of the strongest defenders of unions out there. So you can bet that, you know, and I know a number of other people will be as well. So it's an issue that is not going to escape this Congress. Not being a member of Congress.
Right.
The
Family Flexibility Leave Act, the sham that is, they're saying that you can, you know, work all the time. You'll never get your days off.
And I know.
Big companies to take away everything from everybody.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that should be on the front burner because that's the part that's going to keep the country floating.
Oh, I'd like to see them roll all the way back to 1947 and roll back Taft-Hartley. And I know that Bernie supports that as well. That's probably not going to happen, but who knows? I see, again, if enough of us get out there and enough of us get outspoken and enough of us get start participating at the grassroots level, then we can see that kind of change. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Bronx, New York. Hey, John, we have a little less than a minute left. What's up?
This morning on Washington Journal, C-SPAN's Washington Journal, they had the editor publisher of the American Spectator on there, and he claimed that Ambassador Wilson's report saying that Saddam did not ever attempt to acquire or did not acquire Yellowcake was simply wrong. I haven't heard anything about this before. Have you ever heard about this?
Yeah,
you know,
these are the neocons hallucinating. They're still hallucinating. You had Richard Perle on NPR last Saturday or Sunday saying, oh, yeah, there were weapons of mass destruction. No, there were ties with Al-Qaeda. I've seen them. In fact, he hadn't. These guys are just lying.
Good. Still hallucinating, huh? I'll accept that. I'm glad to hear that.
I mean, there's just no other way to say it, John. These guys, you know, they back in the 60s, they should have just said no. You know,
it's amazing that they're still just throwing out these ridiculous talking points.
And it's amazing that
they would learn their lesson.
Yeah, and it's amazing that the press is still picking them up and running with them. That's the part that's amazing to me. The fact that somebody who's been so thoroughly discredited as Richard Perle is being interviewed on NPR when they would never, ever have a true progressive on there. They just wouldn't do it. No, we'll go to the far right, but not the far middle. It's just not going to happen. Oh, man. Hey, we've got the story here of what Bush just said in Vietnam. This is pretty tragic, really. We have a fascinating interview coming up after the top of the hour, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, a place where reason is our lifestyle choice. David Denholm is with us. David is the president of the Public Service Research Foundation, their website PSRF.org. And David, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Why, thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. I understand that you're of the opinion that government employees are making too much money.
Well, it's not so much an opinion, it's a fact.
Let's
back up. Not that they're making too much, but they are making more than their counterparts in the private sector. And then it becomes a legitimate question as to whether that is too much.
Shouldn't we be asking the question, David Denholm, instead of saying back 25 years ago, before Reagan came into office and essentially declared war on organized labor in the middle class,
I disagree with that, but go ahead.
Okay. Prior to 1980, somebody taking a job in the government sector, my brother, for example, went to work for the state Supreme Court in the state of Michigan. And the wage that he got was pretty much identical to the wage he could have gotten in the private sector. And now the wage that he's getting in the private sector, now the wage that he's getting working for the state of Michigan is probably, I don't know, 20, 30, 40% above what he would get in the private sector. And shouldn't we be asking why have we allowed wages in the private sector to deteriorate and benefits so badly? I mean, it's very, very hard these days to find a job in private industry where you can actually have a pension, to find a job where you can have union benefits, to find a job where you have good, full health care. Everybody's trying to squeeze you 16 ways to Sunday and driving us in the direction of Walmart wages. And then we got guys like you coming along saying, and now let's go after the government employees, the last bastion of unionized employees who've been able to hang on to a decent middle-class paycheck. What's wrong with people having a middle-class wage?
Well, all right. First, Tom, what's the middle class?
I would say I'm using...
I mean, are we going to say that someone who doesn't have a high school education, can't speak English very well, has very little job experience, very little skill, ought to live on the middle-class wages? Is that your proposition?
Yeah. Sure.
Why?
Yeah, I'll give, yes.
I mean, where then are you going to find, I mean, the middle class would be defined perhaps as the middle quintile of income, but who is going to be in those bottom two quintiles?
Well, I think the agreement historically that we have had and with workers in the United States. And in fact, here, let me just frame this for you then. Here's Teddy Roosevelt. This is a recording that Thomas Edison made of Teddy Roosevelt talking about a living wage. He's the guy who first defined the phrase, a Republican president.
we stand for a living wage.
He says, we stand for a living wage.
Which is abnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
Now, he says it's going to vary from time, from place to place around the country.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
Okay, number one, enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living. Number two.
Standard high enough to make morality possible.
Number two, high enough to make morality possible. We have 30 million people, about 10% of America's population right now, living with food insecurity. People literally having to steal food. And about 25% of those people are employed. Provide for education and recreation so you can put your kids through school and put them through college and you can take a vacation every year.
Yeah, for immature members of a family.
To care for immature members of a family. I understand you're laughing at the idea of middle class people taking a vacation every year, but anyhow, this is Teddy Roosevelt.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness, in other words, pay for health care.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to be able to retire. Now, what's wrong with that? If you play by the rules, if you put in your 40 hours a week and work hard and play by the rules, what's wrong with having what Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican president, said is a baseline for America?
Tom, look at who is in that category that you're talking about. You are not talking about people that work. If you look at, for example, the demographics of people living in poverty, the vast majority of them don't have jobs. Here, and you're acting as though because...
David Denholm, the vast majority of people in poverty, below the poverty line in the United States, actually do have jobs.
No, they don't. No, they're not working. And that, I mean, that's as far as I'm concerned, that's intuitive.
We have a poverty level in the United States that's over 13%. We have an unemployment rate that's 4%.
Yeah.
You're trying to tell me that 6-7% spread are people who are not working? We're just making up our unemployment figures, or are we making up our poverty figures?
The unemployment rate is people who are seeking work and cannot find it. There are plenty of people who are not seeking work.
But we're talking about people who are working right now, David Denholm, and you're suggesting the people who are working should not be entitled to raise a family, to have a decent retirement, to have health care, even if they put in a full 40-hour week. You just say, screw them, they're not good enough.
It depends on what they do for that 40 hours.
Why?
If you have to ask that question, I don't know if I can...
Why should we have a society where we're saying, you know, there are some jobs that we're just not going to pay you enough to live on? Why shouldn't
well,
we say...
No, it depends on what kind of lifestyle you're seeking. Now, if you...
This is not about lifestyle, David Denholm. I remember... Do you remember the honeymooners?
You're defining a middle-class lifestyle and then saying that the least skilled, least educated worker, if he puts in his 40 hours, ought to have a middle-class lifestyle.
Yes.
That is preposterous.
You remember the old Jackie Gleason show, The Honeymooners?
Yeah.
Remember what Ralph Cramden did for a living?
He was a bus driver.
No, yeah, Ralph Cramden, and then his best friend, what he did for a living?
He worked in the sewers.
That's right. Here's a couple of guys who are living a middle-class life, and they have no education, and they're working at the lowest-paid jobs. Now, people who are driving buses...
A bus driver in New York never had the lowest-paid job before unions or anything.
Well, it's the result of unions in New York City. It's pure and simple. You look at look at school bus drivers. Look at bus drivers around the country. How is it different? And
you
have bus drivers who are making $8 an hour.
You're a fool of yourself.
No, there are bus drivers here in Oregon who are making $8 an hour. Why would you say that anybody should be paid a wage that they can't live on in this country, in the wealthiest country in the world?
But I don't agree that you cannot live on that.
I see. So you think that somebody can comfortably live on
$25,000 a year? No, you said comfortably, and then you said live on. I am not expecting people who are making $8 an hour to live comfortably. I think that a person making $8 an hour can have food and clothing and housing.
Have you ever lived on $8 an hour, David?
Oh, hey, I worked my way through college on the minimum wage. I know a little bit about what that's like.
I'm guessing then that we're the same age, because I did too. And back 25 years ago.
Well, the minimum wage when I was doing it was $1.65. What was it when you were doing it?
It was $2.15 an hour.
So I'm a little older than you.
Yeah. Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that both of us back in the 50s and the 60s could work at the minimum wage and have enough money to actually live on. And I actually could, I mean, my wife put herself through college working as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. Do you seriously mean to tell me that anybody could go to college right now as a waitress in Howard Johnson's? There's no way. Reagan has totally ripped the guts out of the middle class in the United States.
You know, I think you have a thing about Ronald Reagan.
Well, because we've had 26 years of Reaganism. We had this radical change in 1980. You guys refer to it as the Reagan Revolution, where it was, you know, labor is no longer a senate. It's now corporations that are a senate.
I think what we're coming to is a realization, and despite all the laws that are on the books that say otherwise, that labor is a commodity.
It is not. Labor is human beings.
No, you see, that's where the big divide comes. That if you regard labor as human beings and say, therefore, it is not a commodity.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. It is not a commodity. Labor is not steel. Labor is human beings. And we should have rules in this country that say human beings are treated differently in the marketplace than a block of steel.
Well, you could have all the rules you want. And
we did for 40 years and have built a great middle class.
Invisible hand will erase them.
The invisible, Adam Smith, you know, the invisible hand only appears once in Wealth of Nations, and it appears as a warning. I'm assuming you haven't read the Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, or you wouldn't be saying
that. No, I haven't read it in its entirety. I have read much of it.
Adam Smith was a big advocate of the rights of labor. In fact, in the first three paragraphs of Wealth of Nations, he talks about how labor is separate from all other types of commodity, and no nation can have wealth without labor. David Denholm, an interesting conversation. I appreciate
Tom,
you coming on.
Thank you for having me on. Let's do it again.
Okay, PSRF.org, the website, PSRF. David Denholm, the president of the Public Service Research Foundation. Thanks, David.
Right,
16
bye.
Minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
I got friends with low wages. Now, one thing I've learned, when Americans get burned, they won't just sit and complain. They know their rights. Stand up and fight for jobs that are fair and humane. When those Walmart guys hear the word unionize, they go completely insane. They'll find out who, and boy, if it's you, you're in for a world of pain. They work for Walmart in outrageously bad conditions. Cause the union's missing.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. That conversation with David Denholm really breaks the issue down, I think, so clearly. And in a way, you know, without vilifying David, because he believes what he believes, and he's reflecting well and honestly the conservative worldview in America, which is that human beings are a commodity. And, you know, God bless him for being willing to just say it out loud, because most of these guys, you know, particularly the politicians, the conservative politicians, they just kind of weasel around this stuff. This guy just comes right out and says it. Hey, people are just a commodity. And once you accept that as your foundational mentality, and it has been the case in the United States where that has been the foundational mentality, during the eras when corporations were a senate instead of people, from the 1830s until the Civil War, from the 1880s until 1901, from 1921 until 1932, and from 1981 until now, human beings, I remember when they started referring to human resource departments. It used to be the employee department or the personnel department. Oh, no. They're not personnel anymore. That has the word person in it. They're human resources. And this is the fundamental cleavage between the historic American liberal worldview, that that was held by Thomas Jefferson, that that was held by George Washington, that that was held by most of the founders and framers. Yes, we'll have to set aside for the moment there, some of them condoning and holding slaves. Many of them did not. Thomas Paine, for example. But this fundamental idea, this fundamentally American idea that keeps coming back cycle after cycle after cycle in the United States, gets beat down and comes back, gets beat down and comes back. The Wobblies in the 1880s, the AFL in 1915, the CIO in the 1920s, the AFL-CIO in the 1940s. Over and over and over again, we see this idea coming back that, hey, does an economy exist to serve the people, or do the people exist to serve the economy? And if your worldview is essentially the worldview of the historic royalists, if your worldview is the worldview of the historic feudalists, F-E-U-D-A-L-I-S-T, a feudal society, of a society, as Russell Kirk in his 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, the book that got Barry Goldwater going, the book that got William F. Buckley going. He starts out the book with a chapter. Russell Kirk opens that book, and it's a book that you should read if you really want to understand how conservatives are thinking, because it is, to this day, the Bible of the conservative movement. He opens that book with a chapter on Sir Edmund Burke, the British conservative, who said, and I'm paraphrasing now, but pretty close to I don't have the words right in front of you. This is pretty close. It's from memory. It does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in as servile a profession as that of tallow maker or, you know, candle maker or hairdresser. But it does society considerable violence if such a man is allowed to participate in governance. In other words, to vote or to run for office. Russell Kirk in his 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, echoing sentiments still held today by conservatives. Society should have orders and classes. And those orders and classes should be relatively rigid. When people start moving easily from class to class, when people start easily moving out of the working poor into the middle class, then guess what happens? They start speaking out. And the conservatives look at this and they say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't a good thing. We saw this in the 1960s and the 1970s and the early 1980s in the United States. We had people in the streets. We had cities burning. We had women demanding rights. We had African Americans demanding a place at the table. We had gays saying, hey, wait a minute, we're part of society too. And we had the strongest middle class we'd ever seen in the history of America. People like my dad working in a tool and die shop could raise four boys, put kids through college, he had health care, Blue Cross Blue Shield up until the day he died, and a pension. That middle class is vanishing as quickly as these conservatives can get rid of it. Why? Because that middle class in the 1970s, that middle class that Franklin Roosevelt created in the 1930s with the New Deal, that middle class in the 1960s and 70s stood up and said, hey, we want an equal part of the table, place at the table. We want an equal part of the share of the pie. And we're not going to go fight in your war, by the way. Thank you very much. Just like the last time there was a powerful middle class in the United States, in the 1770s, the people stood up and said to the king, no, we don't want your stinking royalty. We want power from the people. Yeah, I know it's a cliche, but it's real. It's what the Constitution is founded on. 27 minutes past the hour. When you're so downhearted and misunderstood, just over and over and over you heard. Yeah. Hold on tight to your dream. It's your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466, our number. And Chuck in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hi, I have to compliment you on the way you run the show and the respect show for that fellow. It was probably an 8.5 out of 10 in terms of your irritation with his premises, but you guys still were able to show respect and respect after he got off. I drive a bus in Eugene. And I can attest that is the last labor negotiation, they wanted to, you know, send us something toward you know, minimum wage. The people that are not unionized are getting about sub 10, 8, 9, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard to live on $8 or $9 an hour. I mean, it's just the world has changed.
That he thought that he said you could eat and live and all that. What? Maybe if you had a cardboard box for the residents.
Yeah, and if you don't want to have health care. I mean, you know, it's health care for a family these days is $1,000 a month. It's crazy. Yeah. Chuck, thanks a lot for the call and thanks for your kind words. And yeah, I just for our new listeners, we debate conservatives on this program all the time. And one of my goals, and it's always been that way on this program. I mean, we've been doing this for 3.5 years. One of my goals has always been to model how to win the water cooler wars on the one hand. That is, how to have a debate, a discussion with somebody with whom you disagree, and yet not have blood on the floor at the end of the day. And part of it comes out of my own experience of growing up in a Republican household. You know, when I was 13 years old in 1964, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. I had read John Starmer's None Dare Call It Treason. I was convinced the communists were taking over the State Department. I thought Barry Goldwater was necessary. And my dad was in the Republican Party in Michigan, in Ingham County. And I believed in Barry Goldwater. In fact, I'll tell you, 2 years ago, I went back and I reread his last autobiography, No Apologies. And I still think he was a very decent man. And in fact, there's a great HBO special about him. But, you know, within 2 or 3 years after that, by the time I was 16 years old, I was out in East Lansing and I had completely changed my mind, shall we say. And I was starting to have these really knockdown, drag out arguments with my dad, which continued until the day he died just a few months ago. I mean, he died as a Republican, more of a Eisenhower Republican, I'd say, than a Reagan Republican, but nonetheless. And I think it's really important for us to be able to have people in our lives with whom we disagree politically and have a disagreement and at the end of the day still be friends. At the end of the day, still, you know, because we all have these people in our lives, whether they're our parents or our kids or our neighbors or our coworkers or whatever. I just think it's important. It's a useful thing. And it also highlights the issues. And that's really where it should be. It should be about the issues, not about, hey, you're an idiot. No, you're a bigger idiot. No, it doesn't. Yeah, that kind of, you know, that kind of Fox News stuff just strikes me as tragic. Ann in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program.
Yes, I was calling in regards to your conservative person on just now, and I haven't ever called before because, well, I think you're such an educator. I just learned from you so much, but where is his head?
Well, this is the scary thing, Ann. He reflects his thinking is absolutely where the mainstream of the politicians in the Republican Party are at right now, and where probably a third of the Democratic Party is at.
Yes. When you brought up the minimum wage back when we were younger, and the whole cost of living was way less, than just
right.
in the last year, the cost of food and everything has gone up so much. I mean, even making $15 an hour or something is barely making it, actually.
Yep. Especially if you have to cover your own health. I mean, that's one of the things that has just been an absolute killer. You're absolutely right.
Yes.
And thank you for the call, and thanks.
I appreciate so much for you being an educator the way you are.
Well, thank you. I'm doing my best, and I'm having a good time doing it. So that's the best of all worlds. And thank you. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. I got an old used U.S. history book, and if any of your listeners ever get a chance to do this, do it. And I was reading about the beginnings of the progressive movement back
in the you're talking about the one in the 1870s, 1880s, or in the...
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt is what kind of sticks out in my mind around his presidency. And, man, it's like reading a book on current events.
I'm telling you, these cycles keep going along. And, you know, the old saying, I think it was Disraeli, said, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. And it is absolutely what's going on. We are right now in the tail end of the exact same cycle that the United States experienced in the period from the 1920s to 1932 and from 1870 to 1901 and from 1830 to 1860. We are exactly in the same place. We're looking at an economic crash like the great crash of 1856, as I recall, or the great crash of 1896, or the great crash of 1929. We are looking at the possibility possibility of that. We're looking at the destruction of the middle class. We're looking at the wiping out of the purchasing power for labor. We're looking at extremes of wealth and poverty in the United
right.
States. I mean, it is...
And big
yeah, people
business.
Need to read history, I'm telling you.
Yeah, big business was in the pockets of politicians around then. That was getting on people's nerves.
But the other way around, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I did notice that's kind of unusual is that... Well, you see it nowadays. The big business was using corporate media or using media to kind of get their point across.
Yeah.
And then you had this rise of, like, progressive media, the
yep.
Upton Sinclair and, I guess,
yep.
The guy.
Small Hurst. Newspapers, yeah. And,
yeah.
And, yeah, versus William Randolph Hearst, who was the, you know, Rupert Murdoch of his day. Yeah. No, it's history is repeating itself in a way that is just truly, you know, bug your eyes out startling, Steve. And I encourage anybody. You know who chronicles this really well is Kevin Phillips. His last two books, The Republican, today, still, Republican, Kevin Phillips, the guy who wrote the original book back in the 60s called The Coming Republican Majority, predicting the Republican majority. His last two books about wealth in America and the nature of wealth in America. I think one of them is called Wealth in America. I don't remember the titles right off the hand, but they're just brilliant about these kinds of issues.
What Steve, I got in Georgia here, I've got a daunting task. I mean, the rest of the U.S. seems to be going in the progressive direction, but man, in Georgia, I mean, I used to say, you know, I'm a blueberry and a tomato patch, and you used to encourage me, but man, after this election,
yeah,
I'm withering, Tom.
Number one, Steve, you're in one of the few states that has total electronic voting machines with absolutely no paper trails whatsoever. I still don't believe that Max Cleland did not win the election of 2002.
I don't believe that my candidate down the South Side did as poor as he did.
Yeah, so number one, you know, I wouldn't pay attention to the polls. And number two, you've got a media in Atlanta, Georgia, that is just, you know, locked down by the right-wingers. And again, this is why I think that we need to be bringing back the Sherman Act and at the very least saying that defense contractors can't own media companies, for example. Steve, I got to move along. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm a persistent fan of yours. I want to make that clear before I make this statement.
Okay.
I really respect the approach of civil discussion and all that. I wish I were better at it. I'm not nearly as good as you are. But there are some points of view that in time morph into things that are absolutely, you know, we used to be able to view slavery as a difference of opinion. We all know pretty
right.
well now that it's wrong.
Yep.
And treating people as a commodity and treating corporations as persons, I think we're coming to the point where we got to say, you know, that's just dead wrong.
Yeah, it's just like slavery. It's just like apartheid, segregation in the United States. That's the point that I was trying to make. And frankly, that's the point that Teddy Roosevelt was trying to make back in 1912.
Yeah, whether you honestly hold that belief or not, it's a corrupt point of view.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Well, you said it very well, Jerry, and I appreciate it. And you're right. We need to be calling it out. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. I called before. I just wanted to respond to that David Dunham or whatever his name
mm-hmm.
was. This man, he objected to your use of the word comfortable living.
Right.
Comfortable living means having a roof over your head, three meals a day, health insurance, not have to worry where your next paycheck is coming from. These are decent human requirements that health care is also one of them.
Yeah.
And speaking of health care, the labor unions, the auto manufacturers say their biggest item in their car is medical care.
Right. There's
why
more medical care in a car than there is steel.
Why wouldn't they be pushing for universal health care?
They are.
They would be the best
beneficiaries. They are. General Motors, more or less about a year and a half ago, came out and said that some sort of a universal health care program would be a good thing. I think that there was a big wake-up for a lot of American industry when Toyota, oddly enough, was negotiating with various states to site an auto factory in the United States. This was about 2 years ago. And, you know, they had the states competing with each other, and Alabama had ended up offering them, as I recall, $143 million worth of, you know, free land and tax breaks and all kinds of junk. And at the last minute, they just decided, screw it, and they left, and Toyota sited the plant outside Montreal, or outside of Toronto, rather, and who offered them no tax breaks at all. And when they were asked why, they said, because in Canada, we don't have to pay for the cost of health care. And so all that you can give us all the tax breaks you want, but after the first couple of years, those are gone, and we, the health care cost is still with us. And I think American industry is starting to wake up and say, hey, wait a minute, we can't have this. Pam in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hi. Well, of course, it's about your guest.
Pam, we've got to go to a break here. Like, can you hold on just a second? We'll pick this up on the other side. I'm sorry, I wasn't attending to the clock. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
It's true he's been lying to you. You were bound to find out someday. He will do what he thinks he must do. He's a spoiled boy, it's getting his way.
Oh, it's the George song.
And in the anger that's sure to come, you may even hate the place he comes from. Please don't blame it all on Texas. For his low-down ways, though his dirty dealing wrecks us, please don't blame it all on Texas.
Please don't blame it all on Texas. Welcome back. Jonathan, Common Sense in Broadcasting. Tom Hartman with you 9 minutes before the hour. Pam in Lakewood, Washington. We were speaking before we were so rudely interrupted by the need to pay the bills.
That's all right. I want to try to make this as short as possible. I have a personal anecdote. I'm probably the same age as this gentleman that called.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a very strong suspicion that he really did not live through what he talks about. Do you know what I mean? I don't see how he could have. And he calls himself a researcher and doesn't know anything about today's working for. But anyway, as somebody who experienced that when I was young, I wasn't even that young. I mean, I was in the late 50s, and in college, all through college, the minimum wage was $1.65 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, who had worked 20 years at a job, was one of the few who had the rug pulled out of him and lost his job mid-career and had to start over, with his electronics degree that he hadn't used in 20 years as the bottom of the GS pay scale in the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
And could not support his family on that. He was the only breadwinner. My mother didn't work and wasn't educated enough to get what she was.
So your point, Pam?
My point is that then he got injured on top of that. So we were already going into debt. We were unable to keep up the house payments. We were already in debt. My sister, and then he goes and gets injured on the job, and the government won't pay for his disability. So my sister and I, at $1.65 an hour, 6 hours a day, working almost full time during college, and it was only because college was $75 a semester at a state college.
Right, and that's another huge difference.
We were not able to hold our family above water, and we lost our house, we lost our car, we lost everything.
Mm. I'm sorry to hear that.
But you know what I mean? That's two of us, two 18, 19, 20 year olds.
Trying to hold things together on the minimum wage. Yeah,
right.
In other words, the point that you're making is that you believe that he's wrong, that a minimum wage has never really been a living wage in the United States.
Not really, no.
Yeah. I would absolutely agree with you, Pam, and I thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. Prez in San Francisco, California. Hey, Prez.
Hey, Tom. I called you last week, and you needlessly apologized for a rant I got you going on when I was talking about they think that people are basically evil.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, it's glad to talk to you again. I'm so glad we can call you. You're live now.
Well, me too.
I just wanted to tie in a couple things with the economy. It's breathtaking in the first place. The sense of entitlement that some of these people have. The rich people say, like, the guy's kind of like the Barbara Bush syndrome. He doesn't really understand because he's never had contact with it.
Yeah.
So. But
the Barbara Bush syndrome you're referring to is when she was down in Texas in the Superdome with the refugees from Katrina, and she said, oh, this is working out very well for them. They were all poor to begin with, or words to that effect.
Well, that and an earlier one about Neil Bush and Silverado Savings, and the savings and loan scandal, which has been very much forgotten in this whole thing. It's
this
just
was
another...
half a trillion dollars.
I know.
$1 billion. I mean, it's
money. Did you hear what she said about her son, Neil?
No, I didn't.
She said, but you have to understand, he's ethically challenged, she said.
Ha!
Oh, well, okay then, Babs.
Yeah, right. Well, that explains everything.
But I wanted to talk about, real quickly,
about, number one, Social Security. This ties in with the volunteer army and the economics. Didn't they raise the Social Security deduction rate to allow for more baby boomers here a few years ago? Remember that, when that happened?
We had the, in 1982, I believe it was, Reagan doubled the Social Security tax because of the baby boomers. And the baby boomers became, as a consequence of that, the first generation that not only paid into the Social Security fund to fund the retirement of their elders, but
right,
also
the current retirees, right?
That's right. But also began setting aside money to pay for their own retirement.
Yes.
From 1935 or 33, I guess it was, the Social Security. No, 35 when Social Security was passed, or 36, until 1982, everybody who paid into Social Security was merely paying for the previous generation's retirement. In other words, for the currently retired people. And Reagan, the solution that Alan Greenspan and the Senator Moynihan from New York came up with for the problem of this rabbit through the python of the baby boomers was, let's have the baby boomers not only pay for the retirement of their parents, but pay for their own retirement. And so they doubled the income on the payroll tax income, the income, the tax on working people. Reagan signed the largest tax increase in the history of the United States, bar none, never been matched, doubled that tax, and accumulated this huge trust fund. Now, it's been borrowed against, certainly, but still, it's theoretically there. And they accumulated this huge trust fund so that the baby boomers could pay not only for previous generations, but also for themselves. And then around 2040, that trust fund will be out of money, but it's supposed to go out of money. There never was a trust fund before. There doesn't need to be once the rabbit's all the way through the python and all the baby boomers are dead. And so, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's when they made fun of Gore for talking about the locked box. It's a big joke to these people.
Oh, yeah, because they had no intention of following up on the trust fund anyway. I mean, you have to understand where these guys are coming from. Anything having to do with the New Deal, they hate.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
See, that's where they're at.
Oh, that poor gas bag that had to carry the Republican water all these years.
I know. It's just it's tough carrying water. Prez, thanks a lot. It's great to hear from you. We'll be taking more of your calls and more news. And what's up with the elections? Man, it's starting to come together here. We're starting to get a picture of what happened in the 2006 elections and where. And it's not a very pretty picture in terms of election fraud. And machines that maybe were hacked, and people who got thrown off voting rolls, and on and on and on it goes. So we've got a report on that. We're trying to track down the reporter and get him on the air here in this hour. If not, they'll be back Monday, but hopefully in the next 10 minutes or so. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Curious George goes to Vietnam. Pat Leahy is a little upset. A lot of interesting news over at thinkprogress.org. Here's George W. Bush. What do you think about the war here in, and what do you think about your experience standing here in Vietnam? After all, you managed to get drunk and spend the whole year in Alabama instead of showing up for military service in the Texas Air National Guard.
I thought a lot about what it was like, what my impressions of Vietnam were growing up, and and here I am in this country today, and I guess my answer is very hopeful.
After lunch with Australia's Prime Minister, he raised the issue that will ultimately define his presidency. Iraq. When asked if Vietnam held lessons for the debate on Iraq, he answered yes.
One lesson is that we tend to want there to be instant success in the world, and the task in Iraq is going to take a while. We'll succeed unless we quit.
Yeah. Or we'll succeed unless we fail. Is that the Oh, my. Curious George goes to Vietnam. Sally Castleman's on the line with us. She is the, and then we're going to get back to your phone calls and a little more information here on George's trip. But Sally is the national chairperson of the Election Defense Alliance. ElectionDefenseAlliance.org is their website. She's worked to recruit and train attorneys and scientists for election integrity roles. Has a long career in grassroots political activism and comes to the Election Defense Alliance from the Boston-based Coalition Against Election Fraud. Hey, Sally, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Rob Call over at opednews.com just published an article with the headline, Clear Evidence 2006 Congressional Elections Hacked. Is there clear evidence that the elections were hacked?
Well, there's clear evidence if we look at the exit polls that were conducted by the news consortium. The way that it works is they do their polling according to all their mathematical formulas that have been developed over the years and perfected, and they weight each answer according to the demographics.
Right. Now, I think we all understand what an exit poll is.
Okay. So they take that data and they downloaded it onto the CNN website at 7 p.m. as soon as the first polls closed.
Right.
And Election Defense Alliance analysis team downloaded that data and started looking at it. What the consortium exit polls do is the purpose of their polls is not to predict the outcomes. It's actually to be able afterwards to study the demographics of which group voted how. And so what they do is they take the results and they what's called force it or adjust it to fit whatever the announced outcomes are.
Right. In other words, they recalibrate the exit poll after the election using the output of these machines, and that's what happened in 2004. We had the exit polls in 2004 clearly showing Kerry winning by huge margins in several states and on a county-by-county basis, some just startling disparities. And then all of a sudden, about 6 hours after midnight on November, I think it was 2nd that year in 2004, all the exit polls suddenly conformed to the reality of the electronic voting machines because they calibrated them. So you're
exactly
saying they do this. So it sounds to me like what you're saying, Sally.
But what happened this year was in the exit poll, there was a question that acts as like an internal measuring stick, which validates the original answers. On the 7 o'clock poll, there was a question that asked, for whom did you vote in 04? And the fact that the answers were somewhat close to the actual reported vote, which was a 2% margin for Bush in this answer to this question. And if it turns out that 04 was rigged, the end numbers would just be that much greater for how large this was hacked. But let's just assume that those were the correct numbers. I think it came out something like 47 to 49 or 45 to 47 at 7 o'clock. So that indicates that those answers reflected exactly, you know what I'm saying? They were accurate answers.
Right. In other words, there's...
Okay.
Right.
And in that poll at 7 o'clock, there was an 11.5% margin between the Democratic candidates and the Republican candidates.
Nationwide in aggregate?
In the aggregate, absolutely
right.
In the aggregate,
okay.
Yes.
And but at the end of the day, when the electronic voting machines were counted, what was the spread?
It was down to 7.6.
So we've got about a 5% missing, 5% of the Democratic vote is simply missing nationwide.
Or four, yeah.
4%, 4% and change. And that 4%, is that missing in particular states or in particular parts of particular states?
This is the aggregate. So we have not looked at the data by state. And this poll wasn't by state.
Right. Now, I'm curious to what extent this may, instead of reflecting a hacked machine, for example, might simply reflect people who showed up, who had been purged from the voting rolls, who thought that they had the right to vote, who showed up, were told, I'm sorry, we don't have your name on the list, but here's a provisional ballot. They voted on the provisional ballot, which is essentially a placebo ballot. The provisional ballot never got counted because their name wasn't on the voting rolls. But when they walked out and talked to the exit pollster, they actually thought they had voted and their vote would be counted.
Okay. First of of all, I'm not the best person to speak to that, and I apologize for that. I'm not one of the people that crunch the numbers. So.
Well, I mean, either way, it could show election fraud.
But my understanding of this is that that would have actually skewed it further, not less, because they have something called some kind of a cutoff that for those voters that they consider not very likely to actually. It's hard to explain it, but.
Well, the simple thing would be to ask people if they took a provisional ballot or not and not count them. Take that out of the equation.
Or weight them by a quarter or something
like
that.
Right. So the bottom line here is, Sally, you're saying that we seem to have nationally a 4% and change of the Democratic vote has vanished in this last election. And now you folks are digging down into exactly where that happened and how?
We have a lot of data that we've compiled from both demographic data, historical data on elections, but even by precinct level, and then the pre-polling data, and then what came in on election night, both announced outcomes, independent exit polls and canvasses that weren't adjusted, and some of the tallies that we got directly from the precinct. And that, of course, takes a while to be able to really dig through.
Yeah. But, okay, well, we look forward to talking to you when you have all that stuff figured out. I mean, this is a tantalizing beginning, and I salute you all for doing the great work you're doing. People can learn all about it over at electiondefensealliance.org. Sally Kasseman, the national chairperson. Thanks, Sally, for being with us.
Yes, thank you, Tom, for having us.
Good talking with you, and it's going to be interesting to see how this stuff shakes out. It's going to be very interesting to see how it all shakes out. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. John in Whidbey Island, Washington. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, thank you for taking my call.
I
woke up after being up late looking at a very timely related story online that a friend related on the Yes Man website. The very first thing you see is a link to a story, WTO sells slavery to African business conference. And it appears that the Yes Man, who... hold themselves to be honest people impersonating big-time criminals.
Right. These guys are sort of like the WTO version of the billionaires for Bush.
Kind of.
Except they're more. They're people actually take them seriously.
They absolutely took the Yes Men seriously when they presented to this Wharton Business School conference the concept of slavery using the euphemism human stewardry. And they insinuated themselves into the Wharton Business School Conference on Business in Africa and announced the creation of a WTO initiative for, quote, full private stewardry of labor for part of Africa that had been hardest hit in the 500 years of Africa's free trade. And it would require Western companies doing business in some parts of Africa to own their workers outright. The audience included Dr. Lori Agama, Director of African Affairs for the Office of U.S. Trade Representative, and other notables. Agama prefaced her remarks by thanking Schmidt for his macroscopic perspective, saying that the views add detail to the WTO's general approach.
That's incredible.
So the guy that did this, the Yes Man, holding the prisoner, representing himself to be a representative of WTO, was quoted as saying, "This is what free trade is all about. It's about the freedom to buy and sell anything, even people."
Yeah, and that's what it's come down to. I mean, it's tragic, but that's really what it's come down to. The Sago coal mine, the coal mine where these miners died a while ago. I went back and looked at their SEC filings because they had been sold a couple of times. And at one point, in one of the sales, they were bragging about the fact that they had broke the union and their labor was cheaper. 16 minutes past the hour. Could be. Welcome back. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman with you. Yeah, no, I'll at least own up to it. 21 minutes past the hour. Oh, man. Man, oh, man. Our last call, and I'm going to be getting back to your calls in just a minute, but I want to go off on a tangent here for a minute because I think it's a good one. In in 1781, our last caller brought up the issue of slavery. And I talk a lot about the founders and the framers and Jefferson, for example. I wrote a book about Jefferson called What Would Jefferson Do? And in 1871, Jefferson wrote an essay to a foreigner of distinction then residing among us. Now, keep in mind, this is before the Constitution was even written. He said, there must doubtless be an unhappy influence in the manners of our people produced by the existence of slavery among us. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise in the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it, for man is an imitative animal. So he's just, you know, coming right out and saying, this is a terrible thing. It's a bad influence. We should get rid of it. You say, but wait a minute. Didn't Jefferson have slaves? Well, yeah. When his father died when he was 14 or 15, he inherited responsibility for his mother, his family, and the slaves that came with the family. And then when he married his wife, there were slaves that came with her from the death of her father, including her half-sister by her father, whose her half-sister's grandfather was also Jefferson's wife's grandfather. And this was Sally Hemings. So anyhow, Jefferson, on the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., it says, can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means, only a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation is among possible events, and it may become probable by supernatural interference. The Almighty has no attribute which can take sides with us in such a contest. In 1781, that letter that I started out talking about, he said, I think a change perceptible already since the origin of the present revolution. The spirit of the master is abating that of the slave rising from the dust. His condition mollifying the way, I hope preparing, under the auspices of heaven for a total emancipation. As Fawn Brody points out in her biography of Justin, Jefferson, an Intimate History, it deserves notice that his phrase, all men are born free, which appeared 6 years later in the Declaration of Independence, and which has been traced with such zealous scholarship to men of the Enlightenment, first came to his lips publicly in the legal defense of a black man. In April of 1770, Jefferson, a young man then, in his 20s, he was practicing law, and he was defending a slave who was requesting his freedom, and Jefferson defended him. He said, under the laws of nature, all men are born free, and everyone comes into the world with the right to his own person, which includes the liberty of moving and using it at his own will. So why did he keep his slaves? Well, in 1769, the year before that, as a legislator in Virginia, he had written a bill to abolish slavery in Virginia. A relative of his, Richard Bland, introduced it. But it was at his request, and everybody knew it, and they punished him for this by passing laws that made it even harder to release your slaves in the state of Virginia. In 1783, he again unsuccessfully attempted to amend Virginia's constitution, proposing language that said, quote, the General Assembly shall not prevent the introduction of any more slaves to reside in the state or the continuance of slavery beyond the generation which shall be living on the 31st day of December 1800. All persons born after that day hereby being declared free. He also declared a national ban of slavery in the Northwest Territories, the Midwest, and the Western states. So this is, Jefferson worked at this repeatedly, and what kept coming back at him was Virginia making the laws even more rigid so that, for example, if a slaveholder were to free a slave and not give that slave enough money to leave the state and set up house someplace else, then that person could be arrested and given to the church for 2 years of what they referred to as Christian labor and then sold. Jefferson, however, was just in agony about this thing. When John Holmes of Massachusetts, this is after he left the presidency on April 20th, 1820, 6 years before his death, he gets this letter from John Holmes telling him about the Missouri Compromise, where Missouri was allowed to become a slave state in 1820. And he writes, I thank you, dear sir, for the copy you've been so kind to send me of the letter to your constituents in the Missouri question, it is a perfect justification for them. I had for a long time ceased to read newspapers or pay any attention to public affairs, confident they were in good hands and content to be a passenger in our bark to the shore from which I am not distant. And then Jefferson lays out his final thoughts in the last years of his life on slavery. And I have to share this with you before I wrap this up. We'll do it right after the break. This is just an amazing letter, and I'm going to wrap that around, and then we'll come back to your phone calls. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 27 minutes past the hour, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. This time it's the blue pill, I guess. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I want to wrap up this slavery issue because this is actually a very important one. Slavery right now in the world, there are more people being held as slaves in the world today, as we speak, than there were in 1776. But beyond that, we also have to reconcile American history and where we have been and where we're at on this. Thomas Jefferson, 1820, 6 years before his death, writing with a quill pen, his hands cramped by arthritis, he gets this letter from John Holmes saying that Missouri has become a slave state. Now, Jefferson and Madison wrote into the Constitution that in 18, as I recall, it was 1808, I'd have to go back and look, but it, no. Yeah, 1808, slavery would end in the United States, or at least they thought they wrote that into the Constitution. And it didn't happen. And Jefferson was in agony about it. He writes, you know, I thank you, dear sir, for this. He says, I'm not reading newspapers anymore. I'm just, you know, waiting to die, essentially. He says, but this momentous question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I consider it at once as the death knell of the Union. It is hushed. Now, this is where he begins to predict the Civil War. He said, it is hushed indeed for the moment. But this is a reprieve only, not a final sentence. A geographical line. Now, here he is essentially describing the Mason-Dixon line that would, you know, be the definition of the Civil War 30 years after he died. A geographical line coinciding with a marked principle, moral and political, once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper. I can say with conscious truth that there is not a man on earth who would sacrifice more than I would to relieve us from this heavy reproach. The cessation of that kind of property, for it is so misnamed, that's how polite people refer to slaves, is a bagatelle. This is a small issue, a trifle, which would not cost me a second thought if in any way a general emancipation and extirpation could be effected. And then he talks about how by embracing another slave state in the year 1820, America has become a treason to the hopes of the world. He says, I regret. Now, just imagine this guy who wrote the Declaration of Independence, tried to ban slavery in Virginia two different times legally as a young man, tried to ban slavery in the United States, thought he had it written into the Constitution that slavery would end in 1808. It didn't. And now here he is. He says, I regret that I am to die in the belief that the useless sacrifice of themselves by the generation of 1776 to acquire self-government and happiness to their country is to be thrown away by the unwise and unworthy passions of their sons. And my only consolation is to be that I will not live to weep over it. If they would but dispassionately weigh the blessings they will throw away against an abstract principle more likely to be affected by union than by scission, they would pause before they would perpetrate this act of suicide on themselves and of treason against the hopes of the world. The founders and the framers thought they could take the wolf of slavery by the ears and dance to a reasonable conclusion. They were wrong. 620,000 Americans died in the Civil War because they failed, because Jefferson failed. It's easy for us today, here in 2006, to look back 200 years and criticize Jefferson for all this. He used cheap labor from his slaves to maintain his lifestyle, and the consequence of the failure of his efforts to abolish slavery was a bloody civil war followed by 100 years of legal apartheid. Although he rationalized his slaveholding by keeping them in a style that exceeded that of most poor whites of the day, both were grim by today's standards, it was nonetheless a rationalization of slavery. Jefferson's lifestyle was made possible by slave labor, and there's no other way to say it. Americans are righteously indignant and quick to judge him harshly. Yet how many of us would willingly free our slaves? I'm talking to you right now over a computer, over a microphone that is feeding computer systems and wiring that are mostly made outside the United States. In countries where laborers are held with less freedom and in conditions worse than those of Jefferson's slaves. My rationalization is that no companies in America or any other developed nation make any of these components anymore. The computer sitting in front of me, it's made in China. And without parts from China or Malaysia, I wouldn't have a computer. But it's just a rationalization. It's no less hypocritical than Jefferson's. The shirt I'm wearing is made by modern-day slaves. The lamps lighting this room, manufactured in China, where workers who try to organize are imprisoned. Since Levi Strauss just closed their last American jeans factory this year, odds are the pants I'm wearing were made in a slaveholding nation as well. I can rationalize all the products of distant slaves that I use. After all, I don't have to look in their faces like Jefferson did. But it's still just a rationalization. The stark reality is that we in America did not end slavery. We simply exported it. And it's so much more comfortable for us to criticize Jefferson for agonizing over but still using slave labor 200 years ago when we don't have to look into the faces of today's slaves who are toiling and dying at this very moment to sustain our lifestyle. Not to mention the modern-day conservatives who would have us become their slaves here in this nation. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Well, that was powerful, Tom.
It was, I was little clips out of my book, What Would Jefferson Do?
Reference. I'm very, very, very happy you've picked up on the meme of the placebo ballot thing. I see most of our system is set up with placebos all over the place to make it feel like we've got some place to get remuneration, to have recourse, but it's mostly just placebos to make us feel like we've got control.
That's often been the case in this country, Jeff.
Yeah, and right now in Denver, it's been an interesting thing. It's like, when do you call an election invalid? They projected about 180,000 people would come out to vote in Denver based on previous races, like this, governor races. And I think it was actually kind of low because we've never seen motivation like this. Well, 18,000 people, they fell 18,000 people short. And, Denver had lines up to 5.5 hours long. I've got added a form on one of my reportvotingproblems.com website called I Did Not Get to Vote. For people in Denver and Douglas County. And the estimates are at least 18,000 people got disenfranchised here in Denver. So is the election valid?
That's a good question.
Actually,
it's not a good question. The answer is no. The election is not valid. If even one person was disenfranchised, then we don't have, fair, honest, and open elections.
Yeah. And so, but the thing is, they're declaring this a valid race. Also, we've got multiple reports from poll workers that they ran out of placebo ballots for certain precincts, for certain voting zones. So, like in one case, the ballot style 6, they just were told, "Oh, give people this other ballot style." So people were actually voting with ballots that did not represent the race that they're supposed to be voting on. So it was just an absolute disaster. And now the mayor has appointed a panel of people to look at this, and it's important. I'm glad they're doing that. But the whole thing that we had, it was computers that failed.
Oh, yeah.
But the mayor's
that failed or were you know, crippled. I mean, Paul in his op-ed piece over at Op-Ed News is essentially asserting that they put their 4.5 million vote thumb on the scale, and they didn't expect us to turn out 5 million voters.
Yes.
They expected us to turn out 4.1 million.
Yeah, well, what's really bizarre on this, too, though, is in investigating the problem, when it was something to do with, you know, whether it was deliberate or, you know, a failure in the computers, it was computers.
Yeah.
The mayor's panel does not have a single computer expert on the panel. So, you know, it's a lot of, you know, well-intentioned people, but the whole thing is this, having watched this process for years now, I rarely see any computer person who has no financial interest ever involved in any of the decision-making.
Yeah.
Yet computers are the fundamental source of the problem.
Yeah.
So it's rather bizarre. So it's a lot of placebo stuff again.
We need to wake up as many Americans as possible, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, and just, for any...
know, and frankly, the bigger crime in my mind than the fact that we've got voting machines that can be hacked and we've got, you know, voting lists that are being purged and all this stuff. I mean, that's all terrible. That's all criminal. But the bigger crime is that we have, in the years since Reagan was president, we have privatized our elections. We have taken the single most vital part of the commons, which is our interface with our government, because the government controls the commons, and we're supposed to control the government. So the most important, and so you could argue that the most important part of the commons is the government, and the most important part of the commons of the government is the vote. And we have taken that vote and handed it over to three or four large private for-profit corporations. And that's insane. That's like turning Yellowstone over to Disney. It's insane. And it's not to mention, in my opinion, criminal. And that's what we need to be waking people up to, is that privatizing the vote is just wrong. Jeff, thanks for the call. Your website again is what?
Reportvotingproblems.com.
Great. Okay, people can check it out. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America and the rest of the planet as well.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirshner, the folks at Air America Radio, who make this program possible. Turning the gears and spinning the wheels there in New York. To Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org. To Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room. And Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Doug in Ketchikan, Alaska, listening on KUDO. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Yeah, I was kind of interested. I enjoy your program. You have seemed to, you know, base it on logic more than just rhetoric and polemics, which I appreciate quite a bit. But as kind of a liberal myself, I have one problem with the liberal stance. I'm hoping to get your opinion from it. Is if it keeps going in the direction it's going, and we end up with abusive government, it was pretty much foreseen by our founding fathers, and for that reason, not for recreation or others that seem to be promoted, they put the right to bear arms in there. So I'm kind of wondering what your views and how you jive it with the rest of the liberal agenda there.
Yeah.
Because again, like I say,
well, first of all, there's to the best of my knowledge, there's not a liberal agenda with regard to arms policy. I mean, I'll tell you what my agenda is. Okay. I think that every state and every community should decide for themselves. Frankly, I think that it's crazy to think that somebody who lives in Manhattan should be able to just walk into a store and buy a hunting rifle and say, yep, I'm going to use this right out here in Manhattan. On the other hand, when I lived in Vermont, I mean, people drove around with shotguns in the back of their trucks, no problem. I mean, they hunt. I think that every community has different needs, has different whatever, you know, it's different standards. Now, the larger issue, though, is the one you brought up, which is I hate to burst your bubble, Doug, but it's a myth that's been promulgated by the weapons manufacturing industry and their lobbying arm, the National Rifle Association. And I speak with some knowledge of this. I'm a member of the NRA, and I shoot recreationally, not at animals, at targets, but nonetheless, you know, I do that. And the founders and framers, if they had intended for the Second Amendment to be that we have the right to bear arms so that we can overthrow the government if it ever becomes oppressive, they wouldn't have said arms. They would have said the military equivalent at that day, the right to own cannons, the right to own battleships, armies.
I didn't understand it to mean that we could overthrow the government. I understood it to mean more that we could protect ourselves when an abusive government...
No, that wasn't even in their mind. That wasn't even in their mind. The debate, and you can go back and you can read the dialogues between Jefferson and Madison about this, and then the debates on the floor of the Constitutional Convention. The state of Pennsylvania, in fact, put this into their Constitution originally, and you can find the original Pennsylvania Constitution. Jefferson and many of his peers believed that one of the most dangerous things that a country could have was an army that was active during time of peace, because it would get into mischief. And had seen over and over and over again through the history of Europe countries where the military overthrew the government. And this was an experiment at a fairly weak civilian government. And he felt that if we were not at war, we should not have an army. Now, this then leads to the question, how do you defend yourself if you're suddenly attacked? And so Jefferson's solution was to do what the Swiss were doing and continue to do today,
right.
And which is that every man between the age of 17 and 47, that was the specification that they'd come up with in 1787, every man between the age of 17 and 47 should have a gun in his home and be trained in how to use it and be a member of a local militia. The local militia would be answerable to a local authority. That local authority would be answerable to a regional authority, who would be answerable to a statewide authority, who would be answerable to the federal authority. And if we were under attack, then the church bells would ring in a particular way, and everybody would grab their gun and step outside, and the entire country would be the army. But if there was no war going on, there would be no army. And in fact, Jefferson, when he became president, there were over 300,000 men in the army. And when he left the presidency, there were fewer than 6,000. He tried to actually put that into place. He was heavily criticized for that, because they say that we weren't ready for the War of 1812 as a consequence of that. But that was, if you look back at the original Second Amendment banned standing armies during times of peace and created the civilian army. And the second half of it is what got through the compromise. And that's why it starts out a well-ordered militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
But even if we take that as a given, then, and we go on to the modern history of Eastern Europe and that, and see that the countries that were overrun, such as Poland when they had the labor movement going, and were finally just stomped down, how easily they were suppressed, and China the same, Tiananmen Square, and et cetera, just goes on and on, is how easily they were repressed when they had no means of protecting themselves or their views.
If you look at history, though, Doug, you find that those countries that have had the most successful democracy movements, where autocratic states have become democracies in a single generation, the two that are most immediately obvious are India with Mahatma Gandhi, and South Africa with Nelson Mandela, where people did not use weapons. They practiced nonviolence. We saw the same thing with the end of apartheid here in the United States with Dr. Martin Luther King. I would submit to you that those countries that use weapons to try to recover democracy are the ones that it takes several generations to acquire democracy and are the least successful at doing that.
I tend to lean more toward thinking of as a defensive measure, though, rather than an offensive measure.
I understand, but I think that the defensive power of a moral position is much greater and more powerful than the defensive power of arms. Coming up on Monday's program, I'm going to be debating Dan Gaynor, conservative Dan Gaynor, on e-voting, and Jacob Hacker is going to be here on his book, The Great Risk Shift. That and more, and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, a radio support group of, by, and for we the people. And don't forget, my friends, have a great weekend, and don't forget, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.